As 2024 comes to a close, I decided to revisit the top episodes from the last year. If I were to go by my favorites, there's no way I'd be able to choose. I had so many amazing conversations with experts like Dr. Jim Simon, Dr. Mary Claire Haver, Dr. Philip Kraff, Dr. Lisa Larkin, Dr. Corinne Men, Dr. Rachel Rubin, Dr. Kelly Kasperson, just to name a few. But if I look at the number of downloads, which is the best way for me to know your favorites, there were two top contenders that were neck and neck: Top Tips for Skin and Hair with Dr. Ellen Gendler, and Musculoskeletal Syndrome of Menopause with Dr. Vonda Wright. So in this episode, I'm going to revisit Musculoskeletal Syndrome of Menopause with Dr. Vonda Wright. And at the end, I'm going to give you an update on what happened after I recorded that episode. And now, here is my conversation with Dr. Vonda Wright. When one thinks of a medical specialty that's knowledgeable about menopause, usually an OBGYN, family practice doctor, internist, or maybe a urologist comes to mind. Pediatricians, they're pretty much off the hook. But after this episode with Dr. Vonda Wright, I think you'll be adding orthopedic surgeon to your list of menopause experts. I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, gynecologist, best-selling author, and a nationally recognized menopause expert. When it comes to menopause, midlife, and what comes after, I'm betting you've not gotten a lot of information from your own doctor. If women are given good information, they'll make good choices. And I'm here to give you the inside information. I'm old enough that I was just starting out in practice when the WHI came out and women across America flushed their hormone therapy down the toilet because they'd been told that estrogen would give them breast cancer, which of course we now know is not true. I expected the droves of estrogen-deprived women to come in with hot flashes, insomnia, and vaginal dryness, and they did. But what I did not expect was the women who came in complaining of joint pain. In fact, I'm embarrassed to admit that the first time a patient told me that ever since she went off her estrogen, she could barely make it through a game of tennis, her joints hurt so much, I told her it was likely unrelated and referred her to an orthopedic surgeon who I'm sure was as clueless as I was, and more likely than not diagnosed fibromyalgia. Over subsequent months, I kept seeing women who were literally begging to restart their hormone therapy because of achy, stiff, painful joints. And it didn't take me long to realize that there had to be a relationship. And yes, I was one of the few doctors that continued to write a lot of prescriptions for hormone therapy. Yet here we are 20 years later, and the majority of medical professionals don't address the impact of menopause on joint mobility and strength. In this episode, I'm talking to Dr. Vonda Wright, an orthopedic surgeon who's made it her mission to raise awareness about the musculoskeletal changes that occur as a result of menopause and how a lack of estrogen sabotages the ability to be active. And that lack of activity not only impacts bone health and cardiovascular health, but also cognitive function. So today we're talking solutions to protect your bones, your blood vessels, and your brain. So welcome, Dr. Wright.
Thank you so much for having me today.
I didn't know you existed, I'll be honest here. And then, of course, through the wonders of social media, I met you amidst the group of other menopause experts that we knew. And I thought, oh my God, how incredibly wonderful is this, the work that you do? Because quite frankly, a lot of us in the menopause world, we all kind of do the same thing. And what you're doing is completely different. Yeah. So before we get into the details of what exactly happens to bones and joints and muscles and all that, I want to hear about your journey. How did you become an orthopedic surgeon in the first place? And then what made you be such a big part of the menopause world?
So I think I'll go back a titch even earlier than orthopedics because it matters. I too am from Chicago. You practice in Chicago.
I know that.
Yes. So I went to Wheaton out in the western suburbs and then came into the city, did a graduate degree at Rush University, and then went to University of Chicago for my medical school. So I am deep into Chicago. But what's pertinent to this conversation is my first career out of college was as a cancer nurse. So I came out of Wheaton in 3 years, got another bachelor's degree and a master's degree in oncology and nursing. And this was in the early 1990s, right about the WHI time, actually. But in the cancer world, for breast cancer women, we were still doing the tamoxifen trials. So any of you that have been around women's health long enough know, you know, that I go way back. But imagine being a 23-year-old And my first job within oncology was pushing chemo at night. And the model was women would come in for 1 week a month. Now, most cancer care is outpatient. And nurses such as myself would have the same patients every month for their care for 6 months. So we formed these deep patient clinician relationships as women are in the struggle of their lives. And so you can imagine at 23 what that does to a young care person thinking, oh my God, life is so worth it. Life is worth saving at all costs. And I saw the effect it had on patients and on their families. And so, you know, eventually I moved away from administering chemo. I ran the Rush Cancer Institute and ultimately decided to go back to school, but I never lost that deep-seated knowledge that women's lives were worth saving. Everybody's lives is worth saving, but you can imagine being 23 at the bedside, you know, so.
And of young women. I mean, that's what I think people forget when you're in cardiology and other specialties. Yeah. Very often it's more people that, you know, you think, okay, so they're 90 years old and they've got heart disease, but cancer is a whole different thing.
This one woman and I, she was just trying to exert any kind of control she could have in a totally uncontrollable situation. She and I would stay up all night, as I was required to stay up all night, but she was staying up all night buying stuff on QVC, not because she wanted all this stuff off of QVC, but it made her feel normal. So that had a huge impression on me. And I carried that into orthopedic surgery, where I get to take care of people from birth to death. 51% of all people in this country are women. So a high proportion of people I take care of are women. And here's the deal. Women make 80% of all the healthcare decisions in this country for themselves and everyone we touch. So whether it's the mother of a young athlete, it's the spouse of a master's athlete, or she's the athlete herself, I get to take care of them. And so understanding how valuable women's lives are, understanding how powerful women are in the health of this country, that just drives me. Go back to medical school at 28, 11 years later, I get out because I've chosen one of the longest subspecialties.
So when you went back to medical school, was your plan to go into orthopedics?
No, my plan was to go into oncology. Right.
I'm going to interrupt you for 1 second, because my plan was to go into orthopedics. How crazy is that? You know how like the first day of medical school and they say, so what do you all want to be when you finish medical school? And of course, I think there's a study that like 99% of people change their mind. Yeah. But I wanted to go into orthopedics for a very bad reason. And that very bad reason was I was a wannabe ballerina my whole life. Undergrad, I was an English major and a dance major, and I didn't have the talent or the body. But I thought, well, if I go into orthopedics, then I could work with ballet companies and at least get to be part of it and watch ballet and travel all over the world. And who knows, you know, when the prima ballerina breaks her leg, maybe I'll just have to fill in. And then that dream went by the wayside, I think 1 hour into my ortho rotation, when I realized, number one, this was very noisy in the operating room. There was a lot of drilling and sawing and bone chips flying. And I thought, well, this kind of isn't my thing. And then it was just sports talk from beginning to end. And I thought, I don't think I could make it through 4 years of residency where people are talking about sports all the time. So I decided to pivot and I ended up in OBGYN.
You're a different kind of surgeon, and how ironic, there's no bones in the uterus. So
you know. Exactly. And it's very quiet surgery. You know, there's no noise.
Very funny. Although, you know what, your dream came true in me. I've been the doctor for 3 professional ballet companies. And so it is a privilege.
All right. We'll have to talk about that later. Yeah. I want to hear all about that.
How did the orthopedic surgeon, whose body of academic research is in musculoskeletal aging and really changing the way we think about aging in this country, how did I then now become one of the, we call ourselves, I know, and you're included, this is a secret, people, but we're included in this little funny group we call ourselves the Menoposse, because we are out to defend the rights of women in midlife, right?
So that's right.
Well, here's how it happened for me. And when I was 40, I was in the best shape of my life, right? I'm a sports doctor. I was training for triathlon. I gotten out of my fellowship. I was 19% body fat, all the things. I had my first and only biologic child. It was a big time in my life. And I went through my career, grinding it out. I was the doctor for a Division I football team. It didn't happen for women at that time. And at 47, not that many years after I had my baby, I thought I was going to die because I was having heart palpitations. I literally went and got a stress test from a cardiology firm. I'm like, you've got to check my heart. I think I'm dying. I couldn't get out of bed because my muscles and bones were hurting so much. I gained the 30 pounds that I never wanted, never had a problem with, but they were there, right? And so—
And you probably hadn't changed your diet or your exercise routine at all.
Still doing everything I've always done.
Right, and just then, came on.
Now
I thought my scale was broken when it happened to me. You know? So I went out and bought a new scale.
And then time and time again, it's the same, right? How frustrating. So that, but I am like, you know, you, an academic and a curious brain. So I thought, oh my God, I am so going to learn what this is. So I started reading. I read Estrogen Matters. I started doing deep dives. I started doing the research on what is this arthralgia, this total body pain about. And lo and behold, 80% of women in the whole menopause transition will have musculoskeletal syndrome of menopause, as I've now kind of coined it.
Yeah, say that again, because I want everyone to hear this because it is brilliant.
The musculoskeletal syndrome of menopause. And frankly, I borrowed it from the OB-GYNs.
GSM, genital urinary syndrome of menopause. But trying to coin phrases, speaker. I didn't like genital urinary syndrome of menopause. I wanted to call it genital dryness, GD, because the guys had ED and the women had GD. And everyone told me that was too close to God and thought, what else? Anyway, never took off. And now it's GSM, genital urinary syndrome of menopause.
But I pulled you guys' original paper and I said, well, I am going to craft a nomenclature that captures all these things so that we have a consensus to talk about, knowing that estrogen has an imperative role in inflammation, which causes arthralgia, in bone health, in muscle mass, in cartilage protection. I could go on and on about inflammation. It's not just arthralgia. And then, of course, I claim fat as a tissue and the redistribution of it. And so those six things are not widely understood or widely talked about until I raise my hand at every place I am to say, okay, but what about these six? Because here's the thing I want people to understand, and then I'll shut up because I realize I can go on forever about this.
Well, that's why I have you here. So you can go on forever about this.
Well, listen, I have lived through this. So I'm speaking truth from my experience and the experience of all the women I take care of is that for most of us, and every woman's menopause is her own, but for most of us, the hot flashes, brain fog, and night sweats will dissipate. We will get through that perimenopausal melee. But the musculoskeletal syndrome of menopause, unless we get in front of it, is silent and can become permanent, and it is devastating because I'm going to tell you the truth. I am still a practicing orthopedic surgeon. I still have to take call, even at my advanced career age. And I see the future today when I walk into a woman's room whom I've been called to see because she broke her hip. She's laying in bed with the long-term sequelae of no estrogen on her bones with a broken hip. Many times, she is incontinent, and we're putting one of those weird Pure Wick things in the bed, which helps absorb the urine so it doesn't macerate the skin. Many times her heart is so decrepit that we have trouble clearing her for surgery to have her hip fixed. And not infrequently does she have early or late dementia. Those four things is the future I see today. If we do not get in front of some of these suffering that women are having, and estrogen affects all the things I just talked about, but in terms of the musculoskeletal syndrome of menopause, it's all preventable. We can prevent bone loss. We can prevent loss of lean muscle mass. We can help with the inflammation.
But one of the things I want to get to at some point is we're going to spend some time talking about prevention, but whenever I have one of these episodes where we're talking about prevention. And then, of course, I hear from all these listeners who say, well, that was great, but I'm in that crowd that missed out on estrogen because I was taken off my estrogen during WHI. And now I'm 65 years old. And
what do I do?
What do I do? And the one thing that makes me always happy is when their issues are vulvar, vaginal, and urinary, because those you can reverse at any time, even if someone is 95 or 100. But as you and I know, the inflammatory damage that occurs as a result of not just lack of estrogen, but vasomotor symptoms, the hot flashes and all that, once that's done, it's done. Once the inner part of the blood vessels have been compromised as a result of this long-term inflammation, there's no reversing it. There's other things you can do, of course, to help with your cardiovascular health. I don't want to imply like, you know, it's all over. But no. If you start estrogen later in life, you are not necessarily going to be able to reverse those changes. And in fact, that was one of the big issues with the WHI in terms of why people didn't do well, because the damage was already done.
Right, so, at 70, when people were enrolled, right?
Exactly. So what I want to do is first I want to talk about preventative, and then I want to circle back and talk about what can we offer women who that ship has already sailed.
Yes.
But the question I have for you, and I think I know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Are there any other orthopods who know this stuff? I mean, it's kind of like when I was talking to a cardiologist, you know, a little while ago, and we were talking about the fact that cardiologists never tell their patients that they should be on hormone therapy when they're at risk for heart disease, because that's going to be preventative. And this person, of course, was on board because she's one of the few in the know. You're one of the few in the know when it comes to the presence of estrogen receptors throughout the musculoskeletal system and the importance of this. Are you a lone ship on this sea, or do you have colleagues that are now getting on board?
I'm going to answer that two ways. All the female orthopods in midlife know it's happening because they're living it, right? Are they teaching their patients? I don't have much evidence of that. But two women are on board with me. I'm just the loudest and have the biggest social presence. But Jocelyn Wittstein is a colleague of mine from Duke and has the one and only orthopedic paper on frozen shoulder. She collaborated with her OB-GYN partners, Dr. Ford, and got this great abstract published and presented at national meeting. And then National Geographic picked it up and they did a story about it. But here's the truth, Lauren. She has had a lot of trouble getting that published in a peer-reviewed journal.
You're kidding.
No, because the editorial boards are men. And I love men. I love my orthopedic colleagues. But unless you see this as a real problem, you cannot fathom why this is worthy. So she's been rejected a few times in orthopedics. So now she's trying in the menopause literature. And I sure hope it's published, because frozen shoulder is the number one thing people want to talk to me about. So that's number one. The second person who is visionary and has allowed me to do the only grand rounds in the history of orthopedics on menopause is Dr. Lisa Galatz, who's the chairman of orthopedics at Mount Sinai in New York. And believe me, I have suggested to many other chairmen that this is a critical topic. And so what Dr. Galatz did, she brought PM&R, she brought rheumatology, she brought orthopedics to the table, and we had one big grand rounds. But I wish I could say to you, oh yeah, every orthopod knows this. Two are out there doing something about it with me.
There's a difference between people who are doing research and who are talking about it, as opposed to just a simple awareness. I mean, if you were to go up to one of your colleagues at a conference and say, hey, are you aware that there are changes that occur at menopause in the musculoskeletal system? Do you think they would even acknowledge that? They would just say, well, this is aging.
I'm just going to give this caveat so that the whole orthopedic world isn't mad at me. But
I've given up. I'm sure everyone's mad at me.
My colleagues are brilliant. You guys are brilliant. But here's what I think would happen based on what my patients say to me. I think they would look at me and say, what are you talking about? Of course I know about menopause. My wife is going through it. It sucks, but it's part of aging.
Right.
I think that's
the normal part of
it.
Yeah.
It's what we go through.
All right, let's talk about frozen shoulder for a minute, because I did not realize that was such a big thing.
Frozen shoulder is one of the manifestations of being highly inflamed. You know, the shoulder is a very sensitive joint. It's very sensitive to inflammation, whether the inflammation is because estrogen walked out the door, and estrogen has a huge anti-inflammatory effect, or whether you're highly sugared because your diabetes is out of control. Both men and women get frozen shoulder, but almost to a woman in my clinic, when she comes in with air quote shoulder pain, I look on her chart. She's in the transitional age group, 45-ish. And she'll say, I don't know what I did, but my shoulder is killing me and it won't move. I don't even have to touch her. We immediately start talking about, are you sleeping? How's your brain? Blah, blah, blah. just starting to talk about the fact is you're in perimenopause, a frozen shoulder is an inflammatory part of that. You didn't hit it on anything. You didn't injure it. All of a sudden, it insidiously won't move.
Why the shoulder, though? Why that particular joint?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, good question. In the shoulder, the capsule, the inside skin of the joint, for those of you who don't do anatomy, the layer right outside the bones is critical in a shoulder because the shoulder is an unstable joint, meaning it's a blade and it's a ball. Now that anatomy doesn't really seem to work, except if you want a lot of mobility. And so the capsule is so critical. I think it's just more sensitive to inflammation. The collagen starts contracting as it gets inflamed versus a hip, for instance. You can have a stiff hip, but the hip is a confined joint. It has inherent bony stability.
Yeah.
So the soft tissues aren't quite as critical as in the shoulder. I'm hypothesizing. Nobody knows. That's how
it hasn't been studied, I'm sure, because
Nobody's biopsied it, right, to tell us, but that's what I think.
So if you see a woman who's in the throes of perimenopause or early postmenopause who comes in with a frozen shoulder, at that point, if you were to start hormone therapy, mm-hmm. will that help? I will help be preventative. I know I got that, but will it help in terms of curing this condition?
Again, no study, but in my clinic, that is the first thing I suggest, that they make the decision for themselves. I have them, you know, read Estrogen Matters, read the NAM statement, ask me all the questions, and consider hormone therapy, number one. Number two, it's not going to cure it in my experience just by starting it. It can probably make it feel better, make your whole body be less inflamed, but frozen shoulder, once frozen, can take a long time. So that's when we click in the, I'm not a surgeon who likes to give a lot of steroids, but in a shoulder that's excruciating, I will, just to cool it down a little bit. Then we get you in physical therapy to move it. If we can't make progress, then I go out on a limb and I put platelet-rich plasma, draw blood from people's arms, spin off the platelets, which contain a ton of anti-inflammatory cytokines, and inject it. Do I have level one studies for that? No, but I am looking for any kind of anti-inflammation I can do for this incredibly suffering woman. Because what I don't want to get to is the place where her shoulder won't move for 2 years, which happens, and I have to take her to the operating room.
Yeah.
If it's surgically.
You know, let's talk about osteoarthritis for a minute, because women are twice as likely as men to develop osteoarthritis. But when you look in the literature, it's controversial if this is related to estrogen levels. And I suspect I can see the look on your face, what you think about that.
It's so apparent, yeah.
But how do you reconcile the fact that we have a medical literature that somehow is not on board with that idea when clearly in your clinical experience, that is very much the case?
It's just not my experience. We're putting together a paper now. The knowledge of osteoarthritis of menopause has been around for 30 years.
Right. This is not new stuff.
It's not new. It's just not recognized. So what we know is that estrogen is critical for the maintenance of the cartilage matrix. Cartilage is like a sponge with little cartilage cells in the middle, and its job is to absorb 80% of the weight of your body. Estrogen is critical for maintaining that matrix. So when estrogen walks out the door, you may have had pretty good cartilage before, but the matrix starts to break down and we can't maintain it. And that's why we think women rapidly have progression of arthritis after about 50. I mean, it's like the brain. I don't think it's a coincidence that all of a sudden your cartilage goes down the tubes when estrogen walks out the door. And the fact is, there are pretty many laboratory studies looking at the role of estrogen on cartilage matrix. So it may not be clinically accepted, but there really are a lot of articles on it.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because I was interviewing someone a while back and I said, you know, we know that there's estrogen receptors on the bone and we know that there's estrogen receptors in the muscle. Are there also estrogen receptors in the cartilage? And she said very definitively, no.
Oh, yes, and alpha and beta.
Yeah, I know. But you know, and I try when I'm doing these podcast interviews to not ask too many questions that I don't already know the answer to. And when I asked that question to this person, I fully expected her to say, well, of course there's estrogen receptors on cartilage. And she gave such a definitive no that I didn't want to challenge her. But my point is that we have even good menopause experts who don't know this. We have orthopods who don't know this. And yet, as you say, this is not new information. We've known this for a very, very long time. Mm-hmm. So we have a huge disconnect here. And when we talk about how people can't stop talking about their hot flashes and all these things that we know are very important, but when we focus on the longer term issues of cognitive function and cardiovascular function and musculoskeletal function, that's what we really should be focused on. And, yes. and we're not.
Agreed.
So speaking of, let's talk about the role of mobility in cognitive function later in life, because that is an area of research for you.
It is. So in 2004, I began studying master's age athletes. Master's athletes are, I've drawn the line in the sand at 40. The NIH draws the line in the sand at 35. But basically, it means people who are no longer on an Olympic track. And then many of the people I study are 50 and up, because I study athletes in the National Senior Games. And I started out my work wanting to clear the myth that exists in society, even to this day, that aging is an inevitable decline from the vitality of youth down a slippery slope to frailty at death. I never believed that was true, because I had too many examples in my own life and the athletes I took care of, that if we take the variability of sedentary living out of the picture, that we could, by using exercise as a health modality, be healthy, vital, active, joyful. But I mean, the fitness chicks have always known this, but I'm a scientist. I wanted to prove it. So I studied master's athletes. Now, the caveat is they're not pro athletes, because those are gifted people. The people I study are everyday people like you and me, except they are committed to daily, purposeful exercise. And here's what I found. We asked the question, when do you significantly slow down in life, in performance, if you take sedentary living out of the equation? Well, unlike Hallmark wants us to believe, it is not 50, it is 75. So if we invest every day in our mobility, we can stay younger in performance than the myth of society tells us. So that's number one. The next study we did has become an iconic study on its own. It's outlived me. The picture I'm about to describe is on every gym wall. Sometimes I walk and I'm like, hey, that's my picture. We showed in this study that we can maintain lean muscle mass across a lifespan such that the volume is retained, the muscle is not infiltrated with fat, and we can remain strong just by moving every day in a purposeful way. Yeah. The third study we did looked at, can we, by doing impact exercise, maintain our bone density? And the answer to that question was yes. And then we did a couple more, but the one that took us 5 years, because we accounted for every variable, whether it was sex, whether it was education, whether it was marital status, whether it was health status. And the only variable was amount of sedentary living versus active living.
Just to be clear, you're separating exercise from mobility and activity, correct? Not the same thing.
No. Purposeful training versus just walking around. So sedentary people walk from their couch or their desk to the car, to their work. They do no purposeful extra amount of activity a day versus—
because I want to be clear that I'm understanding this. When I think of sedentary, I'm thinking of someone who's basically a couch potato or sitting in their chair all day long, who just really isn't moving, as opposed to someone who is active. So I consider myself, I do exercise as well, but I'm active in that more often than not, when I'm writing and reading, I'm on my treadmill desk. So I'm always moving and I'm active, but that's not exercising. That's just
moving.
Well, it is. I mean, it's by the end of it, but it's not, you know, what I consider to be sweating, weightlifting, heart rate racing. You know, this is, my heart rate doesn't even go up when I'm walking, because when I'm walking slowly, but it's active is my point. It's not sedentary. Why I'm separating it out. There's a difference between someone who's lying on the couch all day versus someone who's not actively exercising, but gets in that 10,000 steps a day, which I know is not necessarily a meaningful number, but that's what everyone uses. But you know what I'm saying? As opposed to the person who then goes to the gym and lifts weights and gets their heart rate up.
So my study studied, the control group was sedentary people who did nothing except go to work, come home, go to work, come home.
Which nowadays go to work, come home means walk from your bedroom to your kitchen.
I mean, I once had a secretary who said, Vonda, I don't walk. And I think she was being truthful. She came to work. She got in her car. She came to work. She sat at her desk. She went home. Because I study master's athletes. These are everyday people like you and me who purposely exercise 3 to 4 days a week. Right. And what I found using the impact concussion tool, which measures 5 executive functions of the frontal lobe, it's a test I had available. It was developed at the University of Pittsburgh in my department. So I took that test that we commonly use on kids and athletes, and I applied it to my master's athletes. And I found that 3 out of the 5 executive cognitive functions were retained in exercising people. And it took me 5 years to do that study because we controlled for everything.
And what age people were in the study?
40 to 85. So for me, as an academic, I always say that of all my studies is most important to me because my brain is the thing I trust the most.
In that study, that was women, correct? Not women and men, or was it both?
No, it's both.
It was both. Okay. And the women who were postmenopause on hormone therapy or off or both?
I wasn't enlightened enough at that time to make that decision because it was in 2005, right? Yeah. It was a long time ago for me academically, but it would be interesting to redo that study.
Right. Because we now, of course, know the impact of hormone therapy on cognitive function and executive function and all. So I think it would matter, but it's so interesting. Sedentary death syndrome.
How about that?
How about that? Talk about a catchy title for a syndrome.
I know.
Sedentary death syndrome. So that's what you've been talking about, a sedentary death syndrome.
It is. And I sure wish I had made that word up. But a doctor at Columbia University in Missouri made it up and I adopted it in 2004. But basically, sedentary death syndrome are the 33 chronic diseases that we die from. Most die from, the number one of which is heart disease, that are directly modifiable by our mobility level, our activity level. Do we move around? Do we exercise? And so everything we die of is modifiable. You take pills for your heart disease, it does not affect your diabetes. If you take pills for your diabetes, it doesn't affect your heart disease, except indirectly. And I can do that for every one of the 33 chronic diseases, but the thing that affects them all is how much you move around. Exercise is the number one preventer of long-term morbidity.
The statistic that really jumped out at me is 30% of aging is based on genetics. And no, you cannot change your genetics or your family history. But 70% is based on lifestyle. That's something that we cannot emphasize enough, because how often do you feel like people say to you, hey, it's not my fault. It runs in my family. This is the way it is. And while we certainly acknowledge that some families have better genes than others, there are things that are modifiable that you can do. And mobility is at the very, very top of the list. Not smoking, mobility and weight management have the biggest impact on how you do as you age.
Well, yes, 70% or more of our health and aging is due to the lifestyle choices we make. But here's the thing, even the 20 or 30% that are hardwired in our genes can be modifiable by our lifestyle choices through epigenetics, meaning how our actions turn our genes on and off. There is one study that I just wrote a book proposal and we were reading this study for it that showed that a single bout of running changes the transcription, which is the activity of 9,800 genes. So everything matters.
But that's such a good point because, you know, I come from a family of big time heart disease. Mm-hmm. And there was a point when I thought, okay, it's inevitable that I am also going to have my first cardiac event in my 40s, like the majority of my relatives have. Mm-hmm. And because I was terrified, quite frankly, and I've always exercised, but that was one of my motivating factors other than vanity. I like clothes and, you know, but seriously, I've always been very much aware that I had this less than terrific family history and,
so
you know,
talking about it.
Mm-hmm. And so far, so good. I mean, you never know, but my numbers are good. I feel good. I haven't had a cardiac event. And I really think that it does matter. And while we have to deal with our genetic tendencies, It's not written in stone. It just That's means right. that we have a greater chance than other people of developing certain conditions. I want to go back to another study that I came across that really struck me, because we're talking about, of course, an entire population of people that end up with no all manner of replacements, joint replacements, because of not only injuries and all that, that's part of it, but because of this inflammation and arthritis and hormonal changes. And there was a study that I came across, and it was a retrospective study, meaning after the fact, that in people that had knee and hip joint replacement surgery, if estrogen was started right after, there was a 40% reduction in revision rates. And I read that study and I thought, wow, are orthopedic surgeons aware of this? Because this is not a small number. This is a million people a year are having joint replacements, of which most of them are women. Most of them are not taking hormone therapy. And if you can get a 40% reduction in someone who has to have a revision of that surgery, why is that not standard of care?
Well, I can tell you, I've never heard of it spoken of at an orthopedic meeting. And that maybe I'm just not aware enough, but I don't think that's what it is.
I don't think so.
I am everywhere in orthopedic meetings. But when you sent that paper to me and I was reading it, and it makes so much sense when you think about bone biology and implants. Those of you who don't know the inside of bones, the bones on the inside are it's called trabeculae. It's a mesh of bone, of osteoid. Right. And it's not solid. If it were solid from one side to the other, you couldn't move because bones would be too heavy. So you have a bark on the outside like a tree, and the inside is this matrix. What happens when estrogen walks out the door? It's not that you don't rebuild bone anymore. It's that there's a disconnect between absorption of bone and laying down of bone. The osteoclasts, the resorbers, get ahead of the osteoblasts, the builders. So you have too much resorption, not enough building. It makes so much sense that this paper showed what it showed, because when estrogen comes along, it affects the osteoclast primarily. It sends them into cell death so they don't get overactive, and it realigns the building process so that the implant, whether it's cemented in and you send bone cement out through the trabeculae, or whether it has a coating so that the bone grows into the implant. There's two kinds of implants, the kind you cement, the kind that ingrows. Either way, you need good bone. And so it makes so much sense that if you alter bone biology and enable the rebuilding of bone to be equalized again, that you would get firmer implants.
Yeah. But it's worse than that, because not only do orthopods don't know this and aren't doing this, but they're doing the exact opposite. How many patients have come to me and said, I'm having a fill in the blank replacement, you know, knee, hip, whatever. And they told me that you must stop taking your estrogen and don't start again for at least 2 or 3 months after, because they were concerned about blood clots. And when I would point out to their surgeons that this patient was using a transdermal estrogen, which was not going to increase her risk of blood clots, they looked at me like I was speaking a foreign language and said, no, she's got to go off her estrogen. And there was no convincing them otherwise.
Right. Because in their minds, blood clot's going to give my patient a PE and kill them.
That's right.
Right. So they're thinking that. But imagine how bad it is in non-women's health subspecialties. The percentage I hear is that 75% of all graduating medical students have never heard of menopause or never spent any time talking about it.
But that's residents. That's residents. Medical school would be bad enough.
Oh, right.
OBGYN residents.
Yes, OBGYN residents. You're the guys who...
No training, right.
Yeah. Imagine then you get into a world with 94% men hammers, chisels, and arthroscopes. Imagine what we don't know, right? So the fact that we don't get the connection between estrogen is not going to kill you, down to what route of administration and the difference between...
We're talking advanced menopause.
it's like a menopause 501 class, not 101 class, right?
Right.
So, gosh. Yeah, I'm so sorry.
Yeah. I'm just so sorry for these women who are being, again, misled and not getting their best health outcomes based on misinformation. All right, I want to move on to another topic, and that topic is frailty. There was a study that came out. It was actually in 2022, so a few years ago. This was a Korean study, huge study. It was almost 8,000 women, and they looked at frailty and hormone therapy. So I know you're familiar with that study as well.
It fits right in with the musculoskeletal syndrome of menopause. The definition of frailty is a VO2 max, which is cardiovascular function, of less than 16 for women, and the inability to do your activities of daily living. You can get up and walk around, but you can't live independently because you don't have the muscle strength, and your bones are osteoporotic, meaning they're just not structurally sound. And then a component of that is also mental resilience. But you become frail by two of the musculoskeletal syndrome of menopause components, which is bone health and muscle health.
Yeah.
And what do we know?
So it's really a continuum of what we've been talking about. It's kind of like the end stage of the musculoskeletal syndrome.
It is.
Yeah. I mean, the statistic that jumped out at me was that in women who had received hormone therapy, they were half as likely to become frail.
Yeah, it makes sense.
And, yeah. And when you looked at the number that ended up in a nursing home, 66% of women who did not get treated end up in a nursing home because of frailty versus 33% of women who did. So that's
double. Ended up in a nursing home. And I think that is a destination none of us want to get to. But when families are faced with what to do with someone who needs 24-hour care, I mean, it's a very hard decision.
Yeah. We haven't talked at all about testosterone. And testosterone, of course, is a human hormone. It's not a male hormone. And just as there are estrogen receptors throughout our body, there are testosterone receptors. And it is somewhat controversial about if you give someone postmenopause testosterone supplementation, what that is going to do for muscles and bone. Mm-hmm. Because when we are prescribing testosterone, it is generally for libido. So what is your take on the impact of testosterone supplementation? And I'm not talking about high doses like maybe athletes would use, super physiologic doses. I'm talking about if a woman is running low based on just winding down in terms of testosterone production throughout her body, do you think that supplementation is going to help in terms of musculoskeletal syndrome of menopause?
Well, my first comment is that I would rather women decide to take estrogen than testosterone, because that is a direct relationship with estrogen receptors on bone and muscle. I don't want women to say, oh, I don't want to take estrogen, but I will take testosterone because testosterone won't.
Well, except testosterone is taking estrogen because testosterone is metabolized estrogen.
Yes.
Right, exactly.
Yes.
Yeah, but I was thinking more not one or the other, but would you, in addition to estrogen, what do you think about also taking testosterone? Because I agree with you. Testosterone would not be first line. But if someone is taking estrogen but is concerned about frailty, about musculoskeletal syndrome, about the medical word is sarcopenia for muscle wasting, do you think that there's a role for supplementing with testosterone as well? Or do you think the data is not strong enough?
I don't think the data is strong enough. However, I do it. Maybe I shouldn't say it out loud, but I do it. Prescribing both estrogen and testosterone for my people who take my advice to build lean muscle mass and bone density.
So that is somewhat controversial, and I certainly don't do it routinely. What I generally do is I'll say, well, how's your libido? And they'll say, terrible. And I'm like, great.
Let's do that.
Great. Let me give you some testosterone and it will help with everything
exactly
else too.
That's why I prescribe it. There it is. That's why.
Yeah, you're actually prescribing it for their libido.
Yes, I am.
Under the umbrella of things that exercise is good for, on my medical feed this morning, there popped up an article about how exercise, of course, is associated with a decrease in cancer. Not new information. We know that people that exercise on a regular basis are going to have lower rates of postmenopausal breast cancers, colon cancer, and uterine cancer. But then there was some controversy about there's eight other cancers that they think may or may not be related to exercise.
The good way or bad way? Meaning
that it's protective.
But protective.
Protective. Mm-hmm. The only thing that, I thought this was actually kind of funny, but makes sense. The only kind of cancer that increases with exercise, do you know which that one is? You could guess.
Testicular cancer and cycle.
No. Where do people exercise? Outside.
Oh, skin cancer.
Skin cancer, melanoma. Yeah, I know. I looked at that and like, duh, I should have thought of that because I was standing up thinking, because, okay, what's the one cancer that increases? So the message there is, yes, exercise, go outside, but wear a hat, wear your sunscreen, all of that. But yeah, melanoma actually is correlated with an increase in exercise. But other than that, there's eight cancers that say that there's potentially a decrease, but somewhat controversial. Three of them have been proven.
Well, and you know, cancer is so multifactorial, it's hard to put one root cause. But if you envision that cancer is caused by high levels of chronic inflammation, it is caused by stem cells going bad and not being able to clear the aberrant DNA, well, then it makes a lot of sense because exercise helps with anti-inflammation. It decreases total body fat, which increases insulin resistance and fat content. It makes a lot of sense, but cancer is so multifactorial.
Yeah. This is exactly what the article is about. It said that we can't exactly pin it to exercise. All right, I want to circle back to something that I was wondering about, is that very clearly when we were talking about musculoskeletal syndrome of menopause and talking about the inflammatory reactions that cause this to happen, every single time someone has a hot flash, that there's a surge of cortisol and an increase in inflammatory markers. And that's why the women that have the worst hot flashes are the ones that have the most heart disease, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all these inflammatory conditions. Mm-hmm. So my question for you, Dr. Wright, is if we have a woman who cannot take estrogen or chooses not to, but she eliminates her hot flashes another way, such as using a non-hormonal drug like fezolinetant, you know, Veozah or something else, is that going to be as protective as estrogen in terms of preventing musculoskeletal syndrome of menopause? Now, I know this is an unfair question because that study has not been done.
Show me the study and I'll say yes.
So we'll be very clear that there is no data and that this is just based on your opinion, because my opinion, for whatever it's worth, is anytime you can get rid of hot flashes, it's going to decrease the inflammation in your body, which is going to certainly be a good thing. But I was just wondering what your opinion is.
Anytime you can decrease the overall hot burn of inflammation, which is cooking us from the inside out, it will help to prevent arthralgia. And I can't say whether it's going to protect the cartilage matrix, whether it's going to stimulate bone. But if we stick to inflammation, I could see the correlation. But I don't want people to just decrease their inflammation with a pill. I want you to stop eating friggin' sugar.
The processed foods. Don't get me started on the ultra-processed process, foods.
Right. Well, this is what happens in my office. Bless their hearts. I love these people. But we're going over how terrible this is to live in such an inflamed state. And people are all with learning to lift. And they're all with me telling them at what heart rate we should aim for to exercise and sleep and relationships and all the things. But the minute I get to, and I want you to stop eating simple sugar and focus on fiber, that is no go. And God forbid I say, and can we please stop drinking a bottle of wine at dinner every day because it's sugar. I mean,
switch to tequila. Is that your message?
Well, you know what? I do happen to know that non-carb alcohol is vodka soda, but that's beside the point, right?
Yeah.
There's a whole lot of other reasons, but yeah. So I didn't really answer your question because I can't answer it as it relates.
Nobody can. I just thought I would throw it out there.
How dare you?
I like doing a little bit of that once in a while. All right. Before we run out of time, because we could go on like this for hours, but I want to circle back to something I promised we would talk about. And that's the woman who says, okay, I get it. I should have started hormone therapy when I was 50, and now I'm 60, 65, and I am aching, and my joints are killing me, and I can't get a decent night's sleep because everything hurts. What would you tell that woman?
I will tell that woman that, number one, every woman's menopause is different. And if they do a careful examination of the risks and benefits of starting estrogen after the 10 years, that there are many OBs in the menopause that would help them make a decision to do that. But
Absolutely. It's not like this law that you can't. So many women think that it is literally practically illegal to start hormone therapy after the age of 60 or 65. And it is individual. Yes. It is all about risk benefit evaluation. And for some people, that is absolutely appropriate. So can you reverse some of these changes which have occurred? Because again, I started off talking about the vagina anytime. You can always turn back the clock on your vagina.
Once your cartilage is destroyed, you cannot get it back.
Yeah.
Can you decrease the inflammation you feel? I believe you can, because that is the pain you feel is from the inflammation, the cytokines. But we get one layer of cartilage in our lifetime, and it is impossible to grow it back. We can put plugs of cartilage back surgically, but we don't grow new cartilage. So can we reverse that? No. Can we build new muscle? Absolutely. And it doesn't, you know, it's better if you have estrogen, but you can grow it without estrogen.
Yeah, I was going to say, not everyone even wants to start estrogen at that point.
I have a lot of examples of women who start lifting heavy in their 60s and grow a lot of muscle. It's totally possible.
Define heavy.
Yes. The literature shows that women in midlife need to lift heavy as defined by what you can lift. And I just make it easy for my people. Four times for four sets. The range is 3 to 6. Because only by lifting
3 to 6 pounds?
Reps.
Oh, 3 to 6 reps.
Heavy means whatever you can lift four times before you're totally fatigued and can't do another one. The reason is we are trying to stimulate muscle protein synthesis and rejuvenation of our stem cells. If you want hypertrophy, then you can lift little weights dozens of times. But if we want to stimulate power, which is what we need to get up off the floor or prevent falling, we have to have more powerful muscles. And that is done with lower reps, higher weights. And everybody's heavy is their own heavy. And here's my example that I commonly give. I can biceps curl 15 pounds until tomorrow, but I can only curl 25 pounds 3 or 4 times before I fail. But in doing so, that is going to stimulate my muscle growth. So that's what I want.
All right, I got to go shopping this afternoon and buy some heavier weights.
Heavier weights,
clearly.
I know.
No, because next to my treadmill desk is where I keep my easily little 8-pound weights that when I'm sitting there and talking to someone, I'm going like this 4,000 times, and that's not doing me any good, right?
Well, it's better than nothing, my friend. It's better than nothing, but if we want power, we have to...
I want power. I want it all.
Yeah, okay, then you must lift heavier.
I must. Ending words. What else would you like to say before we bring this to an end?
You know what? I love people to remember that this time is hard. There's nothing easy about this transition. I've lived through it. You know, my patients have lived through it. It's hard, but I want you to be hopeful that you've done a lot of hard things in your life before. This is not the last hard thing you're going to do. And there are many resources that we have now that maybe our mothers didn't have or our grandmothers didn't have the knowledge. But I also love to end by letting people know that you are worth the daily investment in your health, because women take care of everybody else. We take care of our little people, our neighbors, people, our partners. We take care of people at work, often to the detriment of ourselves. But you are worth the daily investment in your health. You're simply worth it.
Dr. Rhonda Wright, I will put all of your information in the program notes. Everybody knows where to find you. And thank you so much. I learned a lot.
Oh, thanks for having me. I loved it.
So fast forward. At the time that this episode was recorded, Dr. Wright had never published her work, and the term musculoskeletal syndrome of menopause was not recognized or known by the scientific community. That all changed in July of this year. Dr. Wright was the principal author on a paper that was published in Climacteric, the Journal of the International Menopause Society. This groundbreaking paper described, for the first time, a definition and description of the musculoskeletal syndrome of menopause. When most scientific papers are published, it's pretty rare for the scientific community to take notice, much less the general public. But suddenly, musculoskeletal syndrome of menopause was being talked about everywhere. Dr. Wright was everywhere, including a New York Times article titled, "Has Menopause Made You Ache All Over? There's a Name for That." As a result, there has been an increasing awareness on the part of not only women, but also medical professionals about the profound impact that menopause has on muscles, joints, and the downstream impact of being sedentary on cognitive function and life expectancy. And just as important, there's an increasing understanding of how specific lifestyle changes can prevent or minimize the chances of long-term catastrophic events. So how lucky was I to get an interview with Dr. Wright before she and her work exploded? If you'd like to know more about musculoskeletal syndrome and menopause, the link to Dr. Wright's paper is in the program notes. And in my post on substack.com/@Dr. Stryker, I summarize the highlights of her paper. I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker. Thank you for joining me. You'll find lots more information in my Inside Information books and on substack.com/@Dr. Stryker.